Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky, sitting in for Ira Flatow. If you follow what's happening in space, and I'm sure you do, you might recall a famous twin study. The Kelly astronaut twins helped NASA study how a long time in orbit can affect the health of humans. Now a new twin study, this one with a pair of calculating supercomputers, one on Earth and one on the space station, will do a similar test on complex electronics. The study hopes to find out how well software can help protect off-the-shelf computers from the effects of space radiation. Joining me now to talk about that and other stories from the week in science is Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science. Welcome back to the show, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
So NASA already, of course, has computers in orbit. So what's different here?
Yeah, so basically we're talking about planning for long-term space flight, you know, futures where astronauts are going to be exposed to more radiation than they are on ISS and where spacecraft are going to be exposed to more radiation. So primarily Mars, but, you know, who knows where else in the future. And also, you know, when we talk about space computers, you know, the ones on ISS are fairly protected, but when you talk about orbiters like Juno, you know, it took so much work to protect that computer from the radiation of Jupiter. So learning how to make computers better at handling space radiation is just going to help in a lot of different areas. And the idea here is just using software to kind of regulate the computer's performance in a way that will help keep it from radiation damage.
So it's a software protection, not some sort of a hardware box.
Right. So it's about kind of monitoring when there are spikes in radiation and slowing the computer down and, you know, checking its systems and its health in a way that they hope will protect its function.
And they've got one on Earth, so they'll be comparing them over time, just like the humans?
Yeah, just like the Kellys. I want to say it's in Oregon. It's somewhere in the Midwest. And now the other one is up on ISS. So we'll see what happens in a year.
Okay, so moving on, there's news this week about something that might not seem like a big surprise in cancer treatment. So tell us about it.
Right. So this new study found that people who choose alternative cancer treatments instead of chemotherapy and radiation, meaning they don't use traditional medicine at all, are twice as likely to die as cancer patients who use chemotherapy and radiation. And in fact, for colorectal and breast cancer, they're five times as likely to die, which was particularly troubling to me because colorectal cancer is on the rise in millennials and breast cancer is becoming increasingly more common in young women. So the fact that these kinds of cancers, you know, seem to be particularly vulnerable to a lack of chemo and radiation is pretty troubling.
So that's really scary, but it's important to note again is we're talking about people who just didn't do that treatment, not people who supplemented traditional cancer treatment with something else.
Right. And obviously, you know, with your doctor's advice and, you know, keeping them looped in most cases, there's nothing wrong with also using, say, acupuncture or a change in diet to try to improve your health and to help alleviate symptoms from chemotherapy and radiation. Because those treatments are really brutal. There's a reason why people often want to avoid them, but they also work.
And once again, this study isn't about the effectiveness of any of those things like acupuncture in a vacuum.
Sure, right.
Okay. So, well, there's another story that I'm fascinated by, and it's about the problem of plastic in the ocean food chain. We always worry about plastic, microbeads, and all sorts of other stuff that we produce getting into the ocean, and then fish eat it. I wonder, like, why would fish eat plastic? And now we know?
Yeah. So researchers were looking into this question of whether plastic smells delicious. They already found that seabirds who like to eat or are attracted to the smells of certain kinds of algae seemed to like to eat plastic. So researchers suspected that there was something about plastic that related to these algae smells. And they basically found out that plastic is like a perfect petri dish for this particular kind of algae in the ocean, the smell of which signals to a lot of fish that there's food nearby because the algae is eaten by things like krill. So when algae is being burst by these, you know, tiny plankton, then the fish smell it. The fish think it's dinner time. And the plastic is small enough that they just swim right up and eat it.
So the plastic takes on the smell of algae?
Yes.
And that's what's happening? The fish actually smell it and think, eh, tastes like algae.
Mm-hmm. And the researchers were basically able to show that if you soak plastic in salt water that has the algae in it and then take the plastic out, soak the plastic in water to kind of like gather the smell of the plastic, fish react to that the way they do to the algae. So even if it's not still covered in the algae, just the act of floating through the ocean is making it pick up this smell.
Hmm. All right. So I wanted to get to a story. I don't know if you've been following this. There's like an eclipse or something happening on Monday. Did you hear about this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think I've heard something about that.
So you were looking at whether or not all these eclipse glasses that people are buying. I was just in the store behind someone who said, "Do you have the eclipse glasses?" How do you know if they work or not? This is important.
Yes, it's very important. And, you know, unsurprisingly, given how people are, you know, desperately trying to buy glasses for the eclipse, a lot of companies are making ones that are not safe because it's faster and cheaper than getting the proper certification and making the proper lenses. Usually it's really easy to tell. There's an ISO certification that's printed on the glasses that tells you they're safe. Unfortunately, there's evidence that some companies are printing that certification without actually getting it. So if you have glasses that are supposed to be certified and you're not sure, you should check online to see if someone has, you know, checked in with the company that you bought them from. But if you're still nervous, you can look through them. Basically, if you're in a normal lit room, it should be totally dark. If you see any light at all, they're definitely bad. And then if they're still dark, you can use an LED flashlight like from your phone. And you should only be able to see the dimmest light from that very bright flashlight.
So you look directly into a light and you just see just barely any light. But if you see a brightness,
they're bad. You don't want them.
Okay, so if you look directly at a bulb, maybe you're looking for the filament, but
right.
That's about it.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so you can do this test at home, or you look for this ISO code, but it could be fake.
Right. So again, it's you should really try to get them from a reputable seller that's been, you know, that's been verified. I think NASA has a list. A few other websites have lists. We actually have one on PopSci as well. But again, you can run this test if you know they're supposed to be safe, but you're still a little scared.
Probably good to check out those lists in advance. Okay, finally, we'll just end with something. Two new interesting discoveries in Antarctica. One's kind of big, one's kind of little.
Right. So researchers found, I want to say it was 91 new volcanoes in Antarctica and one very old fruitcake. Different researchers. One of these findings is obviously more scientifically significant than the other, but 106-year-old fruitcake, remarkably well-preserved.
106-year-old, where did it come from?
It was probably from an expedition. No, certainly from an expedition. Nobody else was there 106 years ago eating fruitcake. But, you know, it was a very calorie-dense and easily preserved food, clearly. But apparently nobody wanted to eat this one, so it stayed.
Anybody who's had one of those fruitcakes knows you can probably keep them for about 106 years.
Right.
Good. Well, we'll be talking about volcanoes later on this hour, so we'll find out more. 91 volcanoes under Antarctica and one fruitcake. Rachel Feltman is science editor at Popular Science. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. So here's a question for you. Are media portrayals of suicide responsible, and under what circumstances? We're raising this question because the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why has been at the heart of such a debate since it debuted this spring. Psychologists and many parents say it's glamorizing suicide, while the series creators say they're helping to steer teens to awareness and assistance. So which is it? My guest says data from his latest research offers an answer. John Ayers is an associate research professor at San Diego State University. Now, we tried to bring Dr. Ayers on the show 2 weeks ago for this very same conversation. So thanks for bearing with us after a few technical difficulties. Welcome to Science Friday, sir.
Thank you for having me.
So first, catch us up on what people were saying about 13 Reasons Why when it first came out. Why was it so controversial?
Well, there's been a lot of controversy because it follows a fictional high schooler suicide. And on one hand, raising awareness of issues can be important for improving public health. But in the case of suicide, we often know that showing or talking about suicide in the media can cause copycat suicides, showing the suicide act, etc. And in the case of 13 Reasons Why, they violated those standards. So on one hand, experts have been saying the show might promote suicide, while the show's makers have been claiming it's raising awareness.
So this whole idea of raising awareness and trying to get people help is something that Netflix has been touting as others have been raising concerns. So now you have some data to put into the mix here. What have you been finding?
Well, we looked at internet searches because there's not contemporary data from other sources. So we looked at searches where searches tell us what the population is thinking and when they're thinking it. And in the United States, for 19 days following the immediate release of 13 Reasons Why, there were about 1 million more suicide-related searches than what you would expect. And a lot of these searches were for people thinking about committing suicide. For example, how to commit suicide was up 26%. Commit suicide was up 18%. And the search, how to kill yourself, was up 9%.
Hmm. But how do we know that these searches have a direct line towards someone actually having suicidal ideation, that someone might want to commit suicide because they're searching for these terms?
That's an important point. On one hand, we know in the past that suicide searches in general actually foreshadow future suicide rates. But on the other hand, because contemporary data isn't available, we looked at the exact content of the queries. And when someone is searching for the phrase, how to commit suicide, it likely indicates they're just one step away from a suicide act.
Hmm. I mean, what can you tell us about a responsible way to present information like this? Because it's an important topic, and there's probably a point to be made that you could steer people toward something that's a better outcome. So what's your response? I mean, what's a good way to portray suicide in media?
Well, those guidelines already exist. The World Health Organization has used thousands of studies and decades of research to develop guidelines on the types of narratives we should portray when talking about suicide in the media. And as a media personality, you're familiar with those guidelines yourself, undoubtedly. Now, 13 Reasons Why's makers could have followed those guidelines.
Hmm.
For example, they could have not showed the suicide act. They could have not shown this fictional suicide victim seeking help and being denied help. They should not have shown the suicide as being the result of personal differences between friends and boyfriends and girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
90% of suicides are because of mental illness.
So those, yeah.
Not your boyfriend breaking up with you.
And we have to wrap up, but those guidelines seem very important. Dr. John Ayers is an associate research professor at San Diego State University. Sir, thank you so much for sharing the study with us. I appreciate it.
No problem.
When we come back, how do you study the underground life of a volcano? Well, by looking at their crystals, of course. We'll talk more about it right after this.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky, in for Ira. Okay, I'm sure we've all had this experience before. You're savoring a red-colored hard candy, or maybe you're indulging in an icy red popsicle on a hot summer day, and you taste that familiar sweet flavor of artificial cherry. Of course, it doesn't taste anything like real cherries, but why? If artificial cherry doesn't share any resemblance to real cherries, or grape flavor doesn't taste grape, then why do they share their namesake? And where in the world do these flavors come from? This hour, we're going to bring you some of the real news about fake fruit flavors, and we want to hear some of your questions. 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Joining me to guide us on this fake fruit journey is Nadia Berenstein. She just completed her PhD in the history of science from the University of Pennsylvania, focusing on the history of the synthetic flavor industry. So welcome to Science Friday. Thanks for being here.
Hi, John. Glad to be here.
I'm really glad that you're here. And boy, there's so much to talk about, and we've got a taste test and everything. But but let's start with cherry flavor, because cherry-flavored candy, or cherry-flavored popsicles, as we mentioned, really doesn't taste anything like my favorite fruit. I love real cherries, but I know both flavors. Why do they taste so different?
So I like to think of the cherry flavors that the artificial cherry flavors that we find in things like popsicles and kind of cheaper hard candies as heritage or heirloom artificial flavors.
Heirloom artificial flavors, I love it.
Because they give us a kind of glimpse into the flavor worlds of the past. So where flavor chemists nowadays can certainly make or kind of formulate a much more naturalistic cherry flavor,
The kinds of sort of fake fruit flavors that we encounter in some of the most kind of common frozen treats and sugary candies and cheap sodas kind of take us back to the early days of synthetic flavors.
When were those early days?
So the synthetic flavor industry goes back to the middle of the 19th century, which a lot of people don't realize. People think of artificial flavors as kind of coming in after the war with processed foods and TV dinners, but they actually have a much longer history.
So they go all the way back then. How were they analyzing fruit flavors, or how are they developing, a cherry flavor that they thought they might be able to pass off as cherry?
Well, that's a good question. So generally, in the early days of synthetic flavors, they weren't doing the analysis of fruits. There's many reasons for that, but the main one is that it's incredibly difficult. The flavor chemicals in fruit, the chemicals in fruits that contribute to the thing that we perceive as flavor, are present in incredibly small quantities, parts per million, sometimes parts per billion. And it's that chemical analytic work is very difficult to accomplish. So in the late 19th, early 20th century, generally people who were working with flavors, who were making synthetic flavors, kind of took available organic chemicals. And by organic, I mean carbon-containing chemicals, not the kinds of chemicals you might buy at Whole Foods.
Yeah.
and sort of found, kind of seized upon sensory resemblances between synthetic esters, for instance, and fruit flavors.
Okay, sensory resemblances. Help me out here. What are we talking about? Are we talking about taste? Are we talking about smell? What?
So flavor is just multisensory. It's a combination of taste, smell, sight, also tactile sensations inside our mouths, and even hearing. There's a sensory scientist right now at Oxford, Charles Spence, who has done a lot of work on how the things that we hear, the crunch of a potato chip or the music that's playing on a restaurant stereo, actually influences the way that we perceive the flavor that we're tasting in the food that we're eating.
Yeah. So in these early days, where were these compounds coming from? What were they using to replicate, say, fake cherry flavor?
So mainly they were using esters. So esters were generally produced from either byproducts of alcohol distillation, or sometimes chemicals that were produced as byproducts of the coal industry. So there were kind of a limited number of different chemicals that they were using, and they would recombine them in different ways to sort of imitate various fruit flavors.
All right, so we have a little taste test coming up here. Why don't you tell us the story of the grape flavor? The grape flavor that everyone knows. It's purple in color, but that's and you sort of can probably imagine it right now, but how do we get to a grape flavor?
Okay, so this is a kind of crazy story that I found hidden in a manuscript in an archive. But around 1910 or 1911, a man named Gilbert Hurdy was riding a streetcar in Indianapolis. And he smelled a whiff of perfume from a woman who was sitting next to him. And she smelled exactly to him like Concord grapes, like those dark purple grapes that sometimes you find at the grocery store or farmers markets. This was important to him because he was a maker of flavoring extracts for bottled sodas and for soda fountains. So he kind of went through chemical catalogs and he found the chemical in question, methyl anthranolate, which was being sold under the name synthetic neroli, orange blossom essence. So so chemists in Germany and Austria had found this methyl anthranolate chemical in neroli, which is orange blossoms, which was important perfume material at the time, and were kind of selling it as this floral scent. But he seized upon this resemblance with Concord grapes and started using it in grape flavor. And there was kind of a boom in grape flavored sodas in the teens.
Why was he the only one who noticed this? Didn't anybody else like walk by that woman and say, she smells like grapes?
Well, that's a great question. And I think the reason is that methyl anthranolate is a flavor compound in American grapes, in Vitis labrusca grapes, which include Concord grapes. And it's not found in European grapes, in Vitis vinifera grapes. So the manufacturers of this synthetic compound in Germany and Europe wouldn't have noticed the resemblance with grapes because they were eating a different kind of grape.
Interesting. Okay, so we have some Concord grapes here. We've got the last few at the farmer's market. And I'm going to just taste one very quickly just to see. Oh, so this is interesting. I haven't had a Concord grape in a long time, and I promise people I'm not going to chew on air. It does have a little resemblance to that fake grape flavor. It feels a little bit like it's coming from the skin of the grape more than what's inside. So I guess I'm wondering why I am able to taste so much of what the fake grape flavor is, but there's still something that's quite a bit different in there, too.
Well, food in nature, any fruit, has many different compounds that contribute to its flavor. Generally, there's ones that we think of as the characterizing compound. So, for instance, vanillin in vanilla beans. Methylanthranolate is one of the ones in sort of Concord grapes and American grapes. I have some methylanthranolate here, actually, that you can sniff. courtesy of the Museum of Food and Drink, I borrowed some of the spares from their smell synthesizer.
You don't just carry it around with you.
No. No, I should, though, because apparently it's a very good bird repellent.
Okay, so you can pass it over here. Oh, okay.
Right?
So this is the smell of the fake grape flavor.
Right. And you should also detect at least a little bit of a resemblance with the Concord grape itself. And I think, I mean, because I grew up, I grew up eating mostly California grapes, mm-hmm. which are, you know, the standard seedless red and white, and they don't have this foxy flavor, I think is the technical term for it.
What's so interesting about it is that knowing that this is a chemical that you just passed to me from a jar across the table, as mm-hmm. opposed to something that's purple and I might want to put in my mouth, I'm actually also picking up some more chemical smells and something that smells a little bit like a detergent in there, and that might have to do with my other senses too, right? I'm looking at it knowing that this has nothing to do with the grape whatsoever.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Well, if you have questions about fake fruit flavors, you can call us 844-724-8255. That's 844-724-8255. We're going to get to some of your questions in just a moment. I guess one question is, so you have these chemicals, in the 1860s. How did they know you could actually eat them? Like that this was okay for people to consume?
Well, that's a good question. at the time, the science of toxicology wasn't as sophisticated as it would become in the 20th century. There were no standard protocols in sort of the late 19th century for testing these things. In fact, Harvey Wiley, who was the commissioner of the Bureau of Chemistry, who was one of the proponents of one of the pioneering food safety laws, the Pure Food and Drug Act in 1906, famously did this kind of like self-experiment with him and a bunch of hale and hearty young men who called themselves the Poison Squad, who fed themselves, who ate meals with escalating amounts of preservatives in them to test to sort of prove their unwholesomeness. but generally, flavor additives, the flavor molecules in flavor additives are used in such small quantities that they tend to be considered toxicologically insignificant.
Okay.
Since the late 50s and early 60s, there has been a formal system in place for assessing the toxicity of these molecules.
I think we can all be happy about that. let's go to Thomas. He's calling from Barrington, Illinois, because I think he's got one of the questions that I really have. It's one of the burning questions I've been thinking about. Hi, Thomas. You're on SciFry.
Hi. I had a question about the fake banana flavoring. I heard a while ago while reading that in the 1950s, there's a strain of banana that the flavoring is now based off of, but that banana supposedly went extinct. And I was wondering if that story is valid or if it's just another a rumor made up online.
We're trying to find out what fake news is about fake flavors here. So thanks, Thomas. Go ahead. What do you think?
Hi, Thomas. That's a That's a great question. And that's actually, you're absolutely right about the change in the banana regime. Prior to the 1950s, the commercial banana variety that was widely available was known as the Gros Michel. Fat Mike or Big Mike, for you French speakers. And banana cultivation is a monoculture, and in the 50s was sort of a culmination of various kinds of fungal plagues that caused the Gros Michel to be replaced with the banana that we know now, Cavendish. So Gros Michel did have more of this compound called isoamyl acetate, which we associate with fake banana flavor, than the Cavendish. It did taste apparently more candy-like. It's not extinct. You can still find them some places. That flavor has actually, I looked into this story, and one of the most astonishing things about that is that isoamyl acetate-based banana flavors were being sold and used and were actually quite popular in the United States at least 10 years before bananas were widely commercially available. So you see banana flavor in the U.S. in the 1860s, but bananas as a kind of widely available commercial product generally are associated with 1876, the Philadelphia Centennial.
So hold it. So it's probably likely that the first time anybody ever bit into a banana in the U.S., they thought, this doesn't taste like a banana at all. I know exactly what it tastes like. It's this other thing.
Well, people would have been eating synthetic banana flavored candies and confections before they were likely to have tasted an actual banana.
It's kind of amazing. I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And we're talking to Nadia Berenstein. She just completed a PhD in the history of science from the University of Pennsylvania, and she focuses on the history of the synthetic flavor industry. We got a tweet from Tom who says, is it true that artificial cherry and artificial almond are the same? He says, we did an experiment in eighth grade that fooled us with coloring alone.
Huh. Well, that's very astute, actually. So benzaldehyde, which is one of the compounds that's used in these sort of heirloom cherry flavors, is the same compound that you find in essential oil of bitter almonds. And the reason for that, I think, is that in the late 19th century, cherry flavor was more often associated with wild cherries and with cherry liqueurs like maraschino liqueur, which had more of that kind of pit flavor. You find the benzaldehyde molecule actually in cherry pits and stems.
Interesting. Okay, let's go to another phone call. Here's another question that we had. Greg is in Chicago. Let me see if I can get Greg's call up here. Hi, Greg. Go ahead. You're on Science Friday.
Hi. I was wondering. Artificial raspberry flavor and artificial blue raspberry flavor don't taste the same at all. I was wondering if you could expound a little bit on what the differences between them are chemically and, like, historically, you know, when they came to be.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a little bit difficult to answer because there are many kinds of artificial raspberry flavors or many varieties of them. Blue raspberry is an interesting story. I don't fully haven't completely confirmed this firsthand, but part of the reason for the emergence of blue raspberry into the world was that one of the coloring compounds that was used to kind of color raspberry flavored things, FDNC Red Number 2, was banned and made illegal in the 1970s. So sometimes that color would have been mixed with that turquoise blue that we associate now with blue raspberry, blue number one, FDNC blue number one. So I think there's a rumor that a company that had been making raspberry flavored ices, once they could no longer use the dark red, just started using the blue.
But you hinted at this before. I mean, does it change the way we experience the flavor by looking at this thing that kind of looks like, I don't know, windshield washer fluid?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Our perception of flavor is multisensory, so the color of it plays a big role in the way that our brain interprets the other kinds of sensory information that we get about what we're eating.
Well, we've got to go. I just have to quickly ask you, what's your favorite fruit flavor, the fake ones at least?
Oh, man, that's a hard question. But I think, I don't know, I'm partial to fake grape. That's how I got started on this research project, and it still brings back nostalgia.
Well, I'll hand you the rest of these Concord grapes. You can eat them during the break. Nadja Berenstein just completed a PhD in the history of science from the University of Pennsylvania, focusing on the history of the synthetic flavor industry. Thanks for the taste and the smell test today.
Thank you, John.
When we come back, we're going to talk more about big news in the world of volcanoes. It's next. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. When it comes to volcanoes, there isn't exactly a crystal ball that will tell us when the next eruption will take place, but there is crystal debris, which is helping researchers see what's going on below the surface of a volcano. These crystals, formed in the magma chamber, are ejected along with the lava and volcanic ash during an eruption. But trapped inside these crystals is a bit of magma, preserving all the details of what it was like inside the chamber. Scientists are banking on these crystals to tell us a lot of things, including what happens right before a big eruption, sort of like the black box in an airplane. Maybe it can tell us about the ideal conditions for producing the increasingly important element of lithium. Joining me to share what they found when they gazed into these crystal structures are my guests. Carrie Cooper is a professor of geochemistry at the University of California, Davis. Carrie Cooper, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks very much.
And Tom Benson recently completed his PhD in the Department of Geological Sciences at Stanford University. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And if you've got questions about volcanoes, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Let me go first to Tom Benson. So, Dr. Benson, you studied volcanic crystals to figure out the right conditions for producing lithium. I guess I'm wondering, why go after this important element?
Well, as many of us listening can attest to, we all have these little devices in our pockets called smartphones. And many of us drive Teslas or other hybrid or electric vehicles. And in all of these modern technologies, lithium, ion batteries, which a component of which is lithium, is used. And these are very high efficient and relatively low cost batteries that are taking the world by storm. Demand is drastically increasing by the day. So it's really important for us to understand where this lithium comes from in order to meet our future demand.
Yeah, and where do we get the lithium from now? I assume we don't get most of it from volcanoes.
No, we don't. Currently, most of the lithium around the world is mined from two main countries, Australia and Chile. They form in different types of deposits in those areas, in pegmatites, which are the very last stages of a granite, like Half Dome in Yosemite. You can find some lithium enrichment there. You can also find them in salt flats in South America, and that's where the main two current resources are located.
Okay, so tell us about what you find, how you use these crystals to find where lithium resides. What are you learning here?
Right, so lithium is a really fascinating element because one of the fundamental properties of lithium is that it's a very volatile element. So when you think you have a volcanic eruption and it erupts into the atmosphere, people immediately think to places like Mount St. Helens, where you have this big gas plume that erupts. And since lithium is a volatile element, it escapes the atmosphere. And we can't measure it on the rock that solidifies on the surface of the Earth. So we have to use this tricky technique called melt inclusions. And these are tiny little blebs of magma that are trapped in the crystals as it's growing within the magma chamber. So we get to analyze those little blebs because they preserve the pre-eruptive concentration of lithium before all of that degassing occurs.
Okay, so let me go to Dr. Cooper before I learn too much about lithium, because I want to learn more. It's such an important element right now, as you were saying, in our smartphones, batteries, and everything else. So Dr. Cooper, let's go to your study. What were you looking for, and what did you find?
So we're using lithium in a different way. We're trying to use lithium as a signature to try to understand what does it look like beneath a volcano and what happens before volcanic eruptions. And this is important because pretty much everything about an eruption, including whether a volcano erupt, is sort of set the stage while it's below the surface. And so we need to understand what's going on below there if we ever hope to forecast volcanic eruptions.
So tell us more what you're looking at. I gave my layman's example in the introduction, but what are you learning inside these crystals that might be trapped beneath?
Yeah, so what we in particular are focusing on is trying to understand the temperature where the magma is stored beneath the reservoir. And that's important because it really controls the physical properties of the magma. So as it cools down, the cooler it is, the more crystals it has in it. And the more crystals it has in it, the more difficult it is to move. So let me ask you, when you think about a magma chamber, what's your kind of mental image of a magma chamber?
Like a scene from a movie with a whole bunch of lava broiling underneath, and I don't want to go anywhere near it. It's just a bubbling mess altogether.
Yeah, exactly. So you think about this big, giant, bubbling vat of magma, and you are not alone in that. That's sort of the common conception of a magma chamber. And it turns out that what we're learning is that is mostly wrong most of the time. So most of the time, a magma chamber doesn't look like that. It looks like kind of a slurry or a slush with mostly crystal material and then some liquid in between it. So the real question then becomes, how do you go from that state to the state where it's mostly liquid and more of the kind of roiling magma that you imagine when you actually see it during an eruption?
Okay, so what do we learn from that? That sounds like something that's new. So what can we glean from this information?
Well, there's two really important implications in terms of, first of all, you know, the kind of surprising result of what we saw was that it's cold down there. I mean, it's not Arctic cold like we would think of cold for human terms, but by magmatic terms, it's frigid. And so that means it's really pretty cold most of the time. And so there's two important implications, one of which is that when we're trying to use monitoring signals and look for these giant pools of magma that you envision, we shouldn't expect to find them most of the time. Most of the time, it's going to be mostly solid. And so when we do see a big pool of magma developing, that's, you know, doesn't say that it's going to erupt for sure, but that's an unusual situation. We should keep a very close eye on that particular volcanic system.
Is it something? Go ahead.
The other important thing is that we're finding that it transforms from this mostly crystalline state to this mostly liquid state where it gets erupted. That happens very quickly on geologic times. That's years to decades. And so that means that we really need to have monitoring in place on these volcanoes so that we can catch the early signals of something really starting to get going.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, this is important information, but it doesn't replace the real-time monitoring of active volcanoes, certainly.
Absolutely. So what it does is it gives us a way to interpret these active monitoring signals and understand what they mean in terms of volcanic hazards.
If you've got questions about volcanoes for our volcano experts, Kerry Cooper and Tom Benson, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Turning back to you, Tom Benson, when we're talking about what you've learned about lithium in active volcanoes, you're not talking about finding volcanoes and going in there and mining for lithium in the same way that you would in some other part of the world, I assume. You're talking about maybe reverse engineering the process of creating lithium. Tell me more what you're learning and how it might help us create more super batteries that we need.
Right, so with lithium deposits, we're really looking at really old dormant systems. And in particular, what we call in the public, we call them supervolcanoes or large caldera systems. And what happens in I like to think of it as sort of like a recipe to create a lithium deposit. The first one is you have to be within thick continental crust. So within the, say, western United States where the crust is very thick, kind of like a granite in composition. The second component of the recipe is that you have to have this big caldera-forming eruption or supervolcano, and that forms a giant hole in the ground because all of the magma that was once there is then evacuated out to the side, and you have this big depression, kind of like at Yellowstone, which is the most famous example. And then in that hole in the ground, the next component is you have to have a caldera lake that forms. Think of a crater lake in eastern or western Oregon. And then the final component is that you have to have some sort of hydrothermal system or geyser or fumarole sort of activity that creates the exact right temperature and pH conditions in which clays that are enriched in lithium can form. So it's like this four-component recipe that leads to the ideal lithium deposit.
Mm. And so these are found in the types of caldera systems that you describe. How many of those are in the United States, roughly?
Yeah, so there are hundreds of them in the western United States, and we're talking over millions upon millions of years. The current active one is in Yellowstone in Wyoming, but throughout Oregon, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, there are these very large systems, tens, hundreds of million years old, that occur. However, the only ones that would be feasible to be mined for lithium potentially are ones that preserve these caldera lake sediments, because that's where the deposit actually is. And the research that I published with my co-authors, Gail Mahood, who is a professor at Stanford, Matt Kobles, a researcher at Stanford, and Jim Rituba of the U.S. Geological Survey, we really focused on a 16.3-million-year-old supervolcano on the Oregon-Nevada border. And these have well-preserved caldera lake sediments, and it's actually the largest lithium deposit in the whole United States.
So that's pretty important. It's so interesting, Dr. Cooper, because we don't really think about volcanoes unless we're in some sort of direct threat, right? We worry right. about them exploding and devastating a city. But a lot of this research seems to suggest that we should be paying much closer attention to them all the time, because they might help us out.
Yeah, well, that too. But even from the hazards perspective, I mean, it really is an important question to think about. You know, why should somebody in the mid-continent care about volcanic eruptions when there's no volcanoes near them? But I think that one of the important messages to get out is that volcanic eruptions can have very widespread effects. The volcanic ash can be distributed hundreds of miles away from the volcano. And we saw in the 2010 eruption in Iceland how disruptive this ash can be. I mean, that was a very small eruption, and yet it shut down air traffic across Europe for days and caused billions of dollars of economic disruption. So, you know, if something like that were to happen in the west coast of the United States, it would certainly have some significant economic effects, even if you weren't living right next to it.
The information we've been talking about that you're finding in some of this preserved magma, is this something that you can apply relatively quickly to help the monitoring system that obviously already is well in place around the world?
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly techniques that are similar to what we're doing that could be applied in real time. The particular technique that we're using takes a little bit more lead time to kind of prepare the samples and get the analyses done. So it's not something that we could do on the timescale of days and provide information that feeds back into the hazards assessment. But so it's really more like we're trying to reconstruct the events leading up to the eruption so that people can then look at the events that are leading up potentially to an eruption or not, and sort of compare that and see, are we headed towards an eruption, or are we headed away from an eruption, or how do we interpret the signals that we're getting?
We have a call from Francisco, who's calling from Miami. Go ahead, Francisco. You're on Science Friday.
Hi. I just wanted to share with you guys that in Nicaragua, this morning at 2:30 in the morning, Volcano San Cristobal, which is one of the largest active volcanoes in Nicaragua, started a phase of spewing ashes. And I was interested for you guys to know, and those enthusiasts with volcanoes can always visit, and it's a tremendous show, and it's only 2 hours away on a flight from Miami or Fort Lauderdale. So I just wanted to share with you guys that it's in the community, it's in the Chinandega, city of Chinandega. Mm. And also Volcano Masaya, which has a nice viewing area for it. You can see the magma really from the top of the volcano almost looking down. So it's very interesting.
It does sound, and Francisco, it does sound interesting. And I actually want to ask our guests to talk about it in just a moment. I do want to say that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom, have you been following this Nicaraguan volcano that Francisco was talking about?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Oh, I'm wondering if you've been following the Nicaraguan volcano that our caller Francisco has been following.
Yeah, due to technical difficulties, I couldn't really hear what we were talking about. But I have not been following that eruption specifically. However, there are a bunch of active volcanoes that are erupting throughout the world. And I think that one of the most exciting ones that's happening right now is north of the Aleutian Arc in Alaska. And Carrie and I are currently in Portland right now. There's a international conference on volcanology. So it's the largest gathering of volcanologists ever that's currently occurring in Portland, Oregon. So we're looking into places like Nicaragua, Bogoslav, and all these other volcanoes, both dormant and active throughout the world, that are really, we're all looking at them from different perspectives, looking at the seismic activity, the crystals like we've been talking about on this program, and also just geologic mapping and a bunch of different angles. So it's an exciting time to be involved in volcanology when we're all here together this week in Portland.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Dr. Cooper, can you tell us more about that? Because it does sound like an exciting time for a bunch of people who study volcanoes all to be in one big room together. What are the things that you're most excited about happening in your world?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I'm most excited about in terms of, it's a really, I would say broadly speaking, this is a great time in volcanology because we're at a point where different approaches to understanding volcanoes are all sort of coming together in a way that they haven't really been able to before. So the intersections between, for example, looking at the chemistry of volcanic rocks and looking at seismic signatures and looking at computer simulations, they're now actually at the point where they can start to directly influence and interact with each other at the same kind of space scales and time scales. And so we're sort of poised to make some really big advances. And one of the things I'm seeing is that in the volcano science community, there's a lot of excitement about this recently.
But before we go, Dr. Cooper and Tom had suggested this a moment ago, but there are a lot of active volcanoes happening all around the world. How many are you and your colleagues monitoring? I mean, how big a task is this?
It's a huge task. As I said, I personally am not involved directly in the monitoring effects, but the U.S. Geological Survey is tasked with that in the United States. And talking to my colleagues at the USGS, just for example in the Cascades, out of the Cascades volcanoes, only maybe one or possibly two of them are what we would consider to be adequately instrumented in the sense that we could see the earliest signs of an eruption. And that's certainly not for any lack of will or effort. It's simply a matter of resources. So we as a society have to decide where we're going to put our resources, and we could do a lot better in terms of that.
Carrie Cooper is professor of geochemistry at the University of California, Davis. Tom Benson recently completed his PhD in the Department of Geological Sciences at Stanford University. Enjoy the rest of your time at this volcano conference. I hope you find out some more really cool stuff. I appreciate you joining us here on Science Friday.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
To all of you Science Friday fans in Kansas, Ira and the gang are headed to Wichita on Saturday, September 9th for a live show at the Orpheum Theater. They're talking about ancient bones, talking about dung beetles, talking about sea monsters. Tickets, of course, are going fast. You can find out more at sciencefriday.com/Wichita. That's sciencefriday.com/Wichita. And if you haven't yet found your eclipse glasses for Monday, no problem. We've got some instructions on how you can safely view the eclipse, even without eclipse glasses, at sciencefriday.com/pinhole. As we said earlier in the hour, it's really important to view this properly. So go to sciencefriday.com/pinhole to find out more. Charles Bergquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers here at the controls at our studio of our production partners, the City University of New York. Ira's back next week, wishing everyone a safe and happy eclipse viewing in New York. I'm John Dankosky.